Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and discuss the $700 billion bailout and the extent to which it may or may not address the economic crisis. We'll be talking with Naomi Prinz, who's a journalist and senior fellow at Demos, a public policy think tank based in New York. Naomi writes and speaks on economic policy, Wall Street, Social Security, and the political regulatory environment. Her books include Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, and Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pocket, Whether You Voted for Them or Not. Before becoming a journalist, she served as the managing director of Goldman Sachs in New York, and prior to that, she was headed up an analytical group at Bear Stearns in London. And then we'll examine the Palin phenomenon in the context of The Age of American Unreason, a bestseller by Susan Jacoby, who'll be joining us, where we'll try and determine how this exemplar of anti-intellectualism could be so popular, so much so that she is carrying the McCain ticket and could be the next president of the United States. And then we'll look at the Justice Department. Finally, this justice is prevailing at the Justice Department. An internal report found that politics was central to the firing of the United States attorneys, and this possibly could put Karl Rove and Alberto Gonzalez in the dock. And then in the second hour on Live from the Left Coast, we will be joined by Mirna Perez, who's counsel for the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. She recently authored a report available at the Brennan Center's website on the methods of voter registration, list, and purging. So we'll be looking into, in the second hour, the potential for rigging, purging, and disappearing votes in this forthcoming election. We'll also be joined by Stephen Rosenfeld, who's a senior fellow at alternet.org, where he reports on elections and voting rights perspectives. His most recent book is Count My Vote, A Citizen's Guide to Voting. And then in the second half of the second hour in Live from the Left Coast, we'll be joined by Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, explorer, and journalist, the author of The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, The Adventurist, Three Worlds Gone Mad, and his most recent book, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. He originally, in the original war in Afghanistan following 9/11, he was there and discovered the American Taliban and has gone back every year. So we're getting a retrospective on what's been going on in Afghanistan for the last 6.5 years. And we'll be talking about the new hearts and minds approach to counterinsurgency and what the real problems are in Afghanistan. I'm now speaking with Naomi Prinz, who is a journalist and senior fellow at Demos, a public policy think tank based in New York City, where she writes and speaks on economic policy, Wall Street, Social Security, the political regulatory environment. Her books include Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, and Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pocket, Whether You Voted for Them or Not. And, of course, prior to becoming a journalist, Naomi Prinz was the managing director of Goldman Sachs in New York, and prior to that, she ran an analytics group at Bear Stearns in London. And, Naomi, it seems that the bailout may not actually address what the real ticking bomb, as far as I understand, in terms of our economic jeopardy and the global economy, and that is the fact that there's no credit, there's no liquidity. It's frozen. And so let's just deal with that first. Will this bailout, where I'm told that much of this money will go to buy these toxic securities that nobody wants from the subprime meltdown, whose value is yet to be determined, and it's not necessarily going to unfreeze the credit market?
Well, that's right. It would only actually unfreeze the credit market if the credit market was frozen because of $700 billion worth of toxic assets, which isn't the case. The problem with the credit markets is that banks aren't lending to each other, and therefore they are not lending to the citizens on the ground right now. And the reason they're not lending to each other is because they rightfully do not trust each other. There's this multi-layered relationship of borrowing and lending that happens within the Wall Street and global banking community. And it's bank to bank, it's insurance company to bank, it's hedge fund to insurance company. It's all the financial institutions that exist because they can borrow from each other more than they can pay back at any point in time. And the theory is that they're good for it. And at the end of all of this set of layers of borrowing amongst the players in finance, there's money coming in that will make it all whole in the case that it's needed. The problem is that's not what we have right now. There isn't enough money in the system. But more than that, there isn't trust amongst the financial players to deal with each other. And so having a bailout, or really a purchasing plan as I see it, of $700 billion or $1 trillion or whatever, because the language in the bailout plan actually only indicates that amount of money being purchased at one time for assets. It doesn't negate the possibility of there needing to be more in the future. But that doesn't change the lack of trust, and it only alleviates some assets from some balance sheets of some banks. And the questions that were not asked by Congress, by the Treasury, perhaps by the Treasury, but unbeknownst to us, was how much is really out there. And this ticking bomb of credit and freezing and all of that is based on the uncertainty between the financial players themselves and certainly of the rest of the world as to what's really out there and how much is it really eating up of the credit system. And we don't have that answer. So therefore, this can't unfreeze the system.
Well, of course, I'm sure a lot of people recall the movie Wall Street and the mantra from Gordon Gekko that greed is good. Clearly, greed is not good. And I'm wondering the extent to which the global nature of this crisis, since the Europeans just met, and their meeting just finished without agreement, but nevertheless, the impression is from people like Gordon Brown that this toxic mess on Wall Street has infected their markets as well. And this is not a case, as we've often been told, that when America sneezes, the world catches a cold. This is actually an American contagion.
Well, it is, but also Europe has had their own part in this a little bit quietly. What happened was this. Wall Street created a lot of these toxic assets based on, at the bottom of a multi-level layer of toxic assets, subprime loans. You know, think about it as kind of eggs in a carton. You know, the eggs of the subprime loans, Wall Street scrambles them, sells them to more people, they re-scramble them, sell them on, they re-scramble them and sell them on and so forth. So that the relationship between all the re-scrambling doesn't look like the individual loans, and no one can tell which loans were there to begin with. But what happened with Europe was that they were the buyers of a lot of the toxic assets that Wall Street created. But the toxic assets that were labeled by the rating agencies as quality assets, they were labeled AAA, or basically the highest quality type of assets. So these scrambled eggs that were sold to Europe were the highest quality pieces of the assets that were predicated on subprime loans. The reason Europe bought them was because they regulations for the capital that's required as a backup in case what they buy goes wrong are actually lower than the United States. So when all of the stuff was being created on Wall Street in the last 4 or 5 years, there were two main buyers. There was European institutions, and there were certainly U.S. institutions, but the European banking community bought a lot of stuff, and they actually haven't disclosed so far what the losses for that is. And so this kind of blame game back and forth. Wall Street manufactured the products. A lot of European institutions bought them. So there is a sort of multi-connected blame between both of the U.S. and the European counterparties in creating the mess. If there was no demand for some of the toxic assets, Wall Street wouldn't create them. Because there was demand, they were created highly, highly profitable margins and with a lot of very highly profitable fees inside them. And so it's kind of hard to just look at it as a contagion. It's sort of like a contagion that everybody knew that everybody was spreading, but nobody wanted to talk about it.
Well, it sounds like you're describing the greater fool theory here.
Where
it's just passed on, you know, down the line to the biggest sucker.
Well, it is, but and along the way, there's a kind of internal agreement that no one will talk about it or be transparent about it. There was a very severe lack of transparency in the assets that were being created on Wall Street. And those types of assets exploded in terms of how much were being created between, as it happens, 2002 and 2006, which happened to have also been consistent with the increase in subprime loans at the bottom layer of those packages that were being created. It wasn't an accident. But if there had not been demand along the way, along that sort of fool's line, if there hadn't been demand for them and a kind of neglect for what was really underlying the bottom of things that were called good, then it might not have spread as far. It's a circle in that way as well. And the hedge funds in the United States and the insurance companies in the United States were also part of this circle because they actually bought the more risky assets that the Europeans didn't buy. And they sort of backed Europe in a way. So in that respect, there was a lot of foolishness going around, and it was also very non-transparent to everyone. And it still is. This bailout package will not change in any way the uncertainty or the transparency in this entire system.
So Naomi Prinz, does that mean then that the ultimate sucker here is the American taxpayer?
Well, we are, by raising more debt, by the Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson funding the purchase plan of these toxic assets with what will be debt, Treasury debt, which is our future taxes. It's basically a loan against our future taxes because there isn't enough money right now in the till in Washington to cover any of this stuff. In fact, the second largest item on the federal budget right now will become the interest on our debt in general, and that debt will grow to fund this. So yes, we're absolutely footing the bill in that way. We're footing it in the future for something that's going on right now. But more than that, what this plan isn't doing for taxpayers and for borrowers and for individuals in the United States is fixing the problems with the loans at the bottom of this upside-down pyramid of risk and, you know, and newfangled assets and proliferation of all these toxic securities throughout the globe, because to do that would actually mean making whole the subprime loans that have deteriorated. It would mean taking $700 billion, let's say, or some amount of money, and instead of buying junk with it, going to the bottom source of what this junk was created upon, which are the subprime loans, and saying, look, all you lenders who lent to all these borrowers who are about to default or even who have defaulted but haven't had their homes taken away yet and are in the foreclosure process, you have to make those loans whole. We will use that money to say if those loans are down by 20% or 30%, here is 20 or 30%. You go now, you renegotiate that loan with the borrower. The borrower will have their home, and they'll have a new mortgage, and they'll have lower payments, and that will actually contain the problems with the economy at the citizen level and at the bottom of this giant upside-down pyramid of risk and toxicness that has been created by Wall Street and sold through the globe. Unfortunately, that's not what it's designed to do, although the money could be used in that better way.
Well, Naomi Prinz, it seems, though, that this has to go down in history as one of the great crimes to have poisoned the global economy. These anonymous people who all made out like bandits in this kind of reverse Robin Hood where they stole from the poor to give to the rich. And, you know, the what I wonder about, just in a kind of macroeconomic sense, is this country really sort of spending its seed corn rescuing some kind of bottomless pit? And is there any way that we can really get back to the status quo ante and build the economy as these two candidates running for president are promising us? I get the feeling we're in this Alice in Wonderland world where actually we're facing, you know, almost a global depression here. And all this happy talk makes no sense.
Well, it doesn't. It's like the idea of having some sort of a terminal patient who needs a new heart and you give them a new liver. You know, they'll have a better liver, but they're still going to die if they don't get a better heart. And the problem is that the discussion has not even remotely gotten near the core problem. There are two. One of them is, yes, this idea that the money that has gone to the top of the system, if you will, that has mismanaged it so badly and made such a murky, non-transparent mess of things, has infected all of the population, and that the loans at the bottom of this pyramid need to be made whole in order to stabilize the economy. So when the candidates talk about, you know, the need for this package and take on all of the cheer that went on last week about how if we don't do this, you know, Main Street is going to collapse on the back of Wall Street collapsing, so we're not really bailing out Wall Street. What we're really doing is saving the American taxpayer. It's just so far off base from reality that you do kind of wonder what Kool-Aid they're drinking. I mean, if you know, one basic question that you know Obama or McCain or anyone could have asked is, what are we buying? You know, very, very simple. I mean, what is it we're buying and why and how did it get created? Give me a list. Give me like 20 assets. Give me 10. Give me 5. Give me 1. So I can understand what exactly it is that was created, so I can understand whether it makes sense to throw money at it and whether throwing money at it will actually make a difference. And then I can talk about, you know, how this may or may not save the economy. But without doing that, you're giving that liver to someone who needs a heart, and that is not a way to save the patient or the economy. And it would be and the problem is both of these candidates, I mean McCain, who's been advised by Phil Graham, who was one of the key architects of a massive pace of deregulation in 1999, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which undid a lot of what the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 post-Great Depression did, which was a very simple, logical thing that created some stability in the financial markets at the time and for decades, which was if you are a risky investment bank or you are a more stable commercial bank, you have the option of existing as you are, but a commercial bank deals with the public, takes savings and deposits, makes mortgage loans that people can understand based on computations that make sense for everybody, and they will have the backing of the United States government. They will have the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which was created at the time in the 30s, which insures our deposits. They will have rules at the securities exchange level, through the Securities Exchange Act that looked at the validity of what gets traded in the markets, and that will be how things work. And if you are an investment bank, you are on your own. You take the risk, you lose the risk, and that's it. There's no conversation of bailout. There's no buying $29 billion of Bear Stearns to give to J.P. Morgan Chase. There's no buying a stake in AIG and saying that's for the benefit of citizens when in fact it's not. There's a clear division as to what institutions are risky and what institutions need to be preserved to help citizens and have a more stable economy. And that idea has been so dismantled over the past couple of decades from some banking deregulation that happened actually in the late Carter years and then continued through Reagan's years and culminated in 1999 with this repeal of 1933 legislation, that what has been created is this incomprehensible, murky banking environment where investment banks and insurance companies and commercial banks all merge their books together. They use people's deposits to fund speculation, and when it all goes sour, the government is left scratching its head. If I was running for president, or whoever is running for president should question the clarity of our system before throwing money at other things that they don't understand. That would be a way to really move forward in terms of stability for the general economy.
Well, Naomi Prince, just looking at this mega criminality on Wall Street and the extent to which a few people were able to game a system that they rigged for private gain at the expense of everybody else, and we don't know how deep this hole is and how much pain they'll be digging ourselves out and whether we'll even get back to the status quo ante. I guess the only thing that's worse than these criminals on Wall Street are these vacuous clowns in the House and Senate with all this pathetic theater last week. And it turns out that in the $700 billion bill, the Democrats weren't able to get unemployment insurance for the 800,000 jobless Americans. The Republicans stopped them and blocked that one, but somehow they managed to slip through $150 billion worth of pork.
Well, this is that's part of the lack of understanding, willful lack of understanding, no matter what your political philosophy is, of the problem. The problem is the money coming in at the bottom of the system, and if people are unemployed, it is likely they will not be able to pay their mortgages. If they don't pay their mortgages, those loans default. If those loans default, the assets that are based upon them default. If those default, et cetera, and all the way up until all the credit is frozen, which it is right now, because no one understands at the top level what's going on at the bottom level. It would have been more stabilizing to pass that, and it would have been more stabilizing. Just take the $700 billion and do not buy assets that nobody understands, including everybody in Congress and everyone in the Fed and everyone in the Treasury and the presidential candidates. And instead of doing that, and instead of hiring like 10 or 20 advisors or whatever Paulson is planning on doing to manage this mess, put it down at the level of individual relationships for their mortgage loans, for the money that they need to continue to make things whole and contain the bleeding at the bottom of the economy. And so it's really troubling that wasn't the outcome of all of the hysterical negotiations, and we have to save the world by passing this package that was happening on the Hill last week. I mean, it was... It was ridiculous.
But wasn't it deeply dishonest where they all said that we care about Main Street and not Wall Street? At the end of the day, Main Street gets shafted. Wall Street gets a blank check, although they don't know exactly what's owed. I mean, just in closing, Naomi, are we looking here in the United States at a lost decade as happened in Japan in the 1990s when their bubble burst?
I think we are. I think our bubble, the credit bubble that was created and profited from for so long, that we've just seen the beginning of its deflation, is not over. This money, this bailout, won't help it be contained. The stock market itself said that on Friday after the bailout was passed. It'll have some ups and downs, but it won't change the nature of what's happening. And I do think that this deflation will continue. And what's worse than that, at the end of it, the government, the Fed and the Treasury, larger institutions that have more responsibility, more power over the remaining finances of the country. Some went out of business. The other ones, within 10-minute conversations on the Hill, were allowed to merge and become therefore bigger and more risky and more murky. So not only are we losing, and not only are we deflating over the next several years, or perhaps it will be a decade in total, but we have created monsters that we are not understanding, and they are bigger and stronger and more powerful ultimately from all of this than they were going in. And so we're not even going to end at a better point. We're just going to sort of go up a hill, possibly at some point, from which we will go down a cliff afterwards again.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us. I'm sorry that the news is so bad, but we have to face facts.
You can fix it by containing the bottom. That there is a fix. That's the light in all of this.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Naomi Prince.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Naomi Prince, a journalist and senior fellow at Demos Public Policy Think Tank in New York. She's the author of Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, and Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pocket, Whether You Voted For Them or Not. Prior to becoming a journalist, she served as the managing director of Goldman Sachs in New York. And prior to that, she ran an analytical group at Bear Stearns in London. I'm now speaking with Susan Jacoby, who's the author of 8 books, most recently Freethinkers, A History of American Secularism, which was named the notable book in 2004 by the Washington Post Book World and the Times Literary Supplement. Her new book, which is out, is it out now in paperback, Susan?
No, it's out in hardback. It'll be out in paperback in the winter.
In the winter. Well, that's relatively soon. The book I'm referring to is The Age of American Unreason. And Susan Jacoby began her career as a reporter at the Washington Post and has been featured in a number of media outlets, including Bill Moyers' PBS program Now. And I'm hoping, Susan, we can examine the Palin phenomenon in the context of your the book and the thesis, The Age of American Unreason, because it seems, though, that Sarah Palin is kind of an exemplar of anti-intellectualism, and she could be so popular that she's actually carrying the McCain ticket as we speak, and she certainly could be the next president of the United States.
Oh, I have to take a deep breath before I start to answer that. First of all, it actually doesn't surprise me. When The Age of American Unreason came out last winter, I was asked by a lot of talk show hosts on the left. I said, didn't I think that George Bush was responsible for the anti-rationalism in American culture? And I said, no, I didn't. I think that Bush, that somebody like Bush could be considered for the nation's highest office is a symptom of where we are as a culture, not a cause. And I would say exactly the same thing about Sarah Palin. What Sarah Palin's nomination by a major party and someone who once had a brain in his head, like John McCain, I don't know whether he does anymore, would consider selecting not just such an unqualified person, but a person who represents almost every sort of fringe anti-rationalism you can imagine. Sarah Palin is a religious fundamentalist, but she's a particular kind of religious fundamentalist. She has been associated her entire adult life, has worshipped her entire adult life at churches which believe in things ranging from witchcraft to a completely literal interpretation of the Bible. She believes in a lot of things that would make terrible public policy, and I don't indeed care whether Sarah Palin believes in witchcraft any more than I care whether Joe Biden believes in the Roman Catholic doctrine of the transubstantiation. What I care about is what these people think about how their faith should apply to public policy. And Joe Biden draws a clear line between his private faith and public policy, and Sarah Palin doesn't.
Well, I think, though, it's almost in your face at the moment, Susan Jacoby, the extent to which it appears, particularly after this last vice presidential debate, that McCain and Palin are actually celebrating their anti-intellectualism, that certainty is better than knowledge, belief more important than fact, and the message and the mission beats vision and leadership. And they seem to be congratulating themselves on their ability to cover up Sarah Palin's lack of knowledge of the Constitution and the Supreme Court. And they're proud of the fact that she doesn't read newspapers or do press conferences.
Well, actually, they're not trying to cover it up. That's the whole point. What Palin represents is the perfect melding of anti-intellectualism and anti-rationalism with anti-elitism, meaning anti-anybody who believes that having a good education is an asset, not a liability, anybody who believes in religion that accommodates secular knowledge as opposed to religion that rejects it. And look, during the debate, we heard it very contemptuously when over and over again she didn't answer questions, and she said, essentially, and I'm not really paraphrasing very much, too bad for you if I don't answer the questions the moderator asks or the way that you want me to. And she would simply go off and say something else and not answer the question at all. In other words, just asking a rational question about what you think about economic policy or foreign policy is something I don't have to answer because I know what I know, and who cares if you elitist moderator or you elitist college graduate ask a question about this. Nothing obliges me to answer.
So this is really forging a dichotomy here between small-town certainty and big city intellectualism.
Oh, well, I mean, I think that's kind of libeling small towns, as she does. I want to tell you, I know plenty of people who came from Alaska, and they don't share Sarah Palin's views. And I know plenty of people from small towns who don't share Sarah Palin's views. But that's one way of putting it. If one of the things that universities are seen and big cities are seen as the locus of all these things which are opposed to normative American values. I mean, I just loved what she said during the debate about how, when the one question was asked about gay marriage, which of course she's opposed to, but she said, of course, they must be tolerated. I guess what she meant is we don't weight them in a sack down with stones and throw them in the water and see if they float to prove that they're not witches.
Well, Susan Jacoby, it is amazing.
It's frightening. It does frighten me. I thought that I could never have underestimated the lack of intelligence of a large segment of the American people, but that anybody could think that someone who holds the beliefs she proudly says that she holds ought to hold national office, it's really quite frightening.
Mm, sure. Sarah Palin is out Mencken-ing H.L. Mencken.
Yeah, but it's not, as I said, it isn't her. The
right.
fact that she, in other words, what she has been brought into, Bill Moyers used a lovely phrase once. He said the normalization of ideas that ought to belong to a lunatic fringe. That's what Sarah Palin represents. The normalization of ideas, if you can call them that, that would once have been dismissed as the province of a lunatic fringe. I cannot imagine 40 years ago, 30 years ago, even 20 years ago, somebody who appears in some kind of a black hooded garment to be blessed against witchcraft before she runs for the governorship of Alaska, I cannot imagine that that would not have immediately disqualified even Spiro Tiagnu from being Richard Nixon's running mate. That Sarah Palin is considered within the bounds of the normal, and people are talking about, you know, her patent leather high heels instead of her crazy ideas, and they are crazy, represents a normalization of something that should be out of bounds in American political life.
But it seems, Susan Jacoby, that we, in fact, that the campaign, the Republican campaign, is going to get ramped up in terms of their feeding class resentment, racism, the subtext of racism, and un-Americanism. Just yesterday, Sarah Palin referred to Barack Obama as having palled around with terrorists who want to destroy our country. I think that's just, the sort of tip of what's coming down the pike. And what I find extraordinary is, how could it be that the Democrats are on the defensive and being called elitists, and the Republicans are able to exploit class resentments when they are the party of the fat cats and the malefactors of great wealth, as Teddy Roosevelt referred to them? They're the beneficiaries of these last 8 years of class warfare, where the rich have gotten extraordinarily richer and the poor have gotten manifestly poorer, and yet somehow the Republicans are able to turn around and exploit class resentment.
Well, here's the thing. Class, as a lot of Americans see it, and we don't talk about it, it is class resentment, but it's not put that way. Class, as a lot of Americans view it, has almost nothing to do with money. We sort of leave money and who actually is the upper class in terms of financial privilege. We sort of leave that aside. And in this respect, this is why the Republican campaign is so closely melded with anti-intellectualism. Elitism is not defined as being rich, or elitist or elite is not defined as being rich. It's defined as perhaps thinking things that are not lowest common denominator thought. It's perhaps thinking that it's better if you can send your kid to a four-year university instead of to a community college, that it's better to belong to a religion that accommodates secular knowledge than to have a religious faith that insists that the earth was actually created in 6 days and is no more than 4,000 years old, that it's better to believe that the right thing to do if you get pregnant is to get married when you're 17, speaking of anti-rational, not looking at the divorce rate for 17 and 18-year-olds. But this is not so much, it's not at all about money. It's been a very brilliant right-wing strategy to take the idea of class out of the realm of money and make it stand for a whole series of values, supposedly un-American values, that are opposed by the right wing of the Republican Party, to which John McCain did not used to belong, but does now.
Well, it does appear to be effective, and I'm just wondering how...
Well, we don't know how effective it is.
Yeah, well I was going to say...
We don't actually know if Sarah Palin is getting any votes beyond that base of the Republican Party, which has been energized by her. There is definite indication in new polling data that a lot of the women who were originally intrigued by Sarah Palin looking at her ideas don't like her. So we don't know how it's all going to turn out yet. We don't know if this appeal, this anti-intellectual appeal, this Obama is the elitist appeal, a guy raised by a single mother who got to school on scholarships, that he's somehow the elitist. We don't know if it's going to work yet.
Well, I suppose, though, if as predicted and as expected, the Republicans do get nasty and change the subject from the economy to whether or not Obama is a Muslim,
it's pretty hard to change that subject right now, I think.
Well, assuming that they just come out with, Obama's a Muslim, he hangs out with terrorists, whatever, wink, wink, nod, nod, he's actually a black and he's not like us and he's not a real American, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that will, you just mentioned that she's solidifying the base that she already has, but there's no data to suggest that she's gone beyond that. I'm wondering whether in solidifying and energizing the base, they don't alienate the center and the independents.
Well, that could happen. When I said that it's difficult to change the subject, I mean, if I were Barack Obama, and this is now he's, and in fact, another thing in this campaign, which Palin didn't start, but she's certainly finishing, is talking about someone because they try to talk rationally about things, as if just being rational means that you're cold and you don't understand the problems of ordinary people. That is the label they've tagged on Obama. If I were Obama, I think candidates always fail when they try to be something they're not. I think that's why John Kerry was defeated the last time. If I were Obama, I would say naturally they're reviving these lies because they don't have a leg to stand on when it comes to what they've done to you, the average American working person, in economic terms. So naturally, they would rather bring out old lies that have nothing to do with what they're responsible for, which is that the value of your 401k has fallen, that you can't sell your house, that you're worried every day about whether you're going to lose your job. I think if you are the rational candidate, and I believe Obama is, and I believe anybody compared to the stuff that Palin and McCain are now promoting would be the rational candidate, I don't think the way you deal with this is indulging in more anti-rational talk yourself. I think it's in being who you are and saying, if looking at the facts and looking at evidence and figuring out what will really help people is being elitist, then, well, I'm an elitist. But being stupid and trying to change the subject, if I were running for office, that's what I would say, because you don't fight anti-rationalism with more anti-rationalism. There are people who disagree with me about that, by the way.
Sure, and I agree with you, Susan Jacoby, but I'm still puzzled how you win arguments against people who don't believe in data.
You can't. That's the point.
I see.
So
what do you do then?
You can't win arguments with people who believe in data, which is why I don't believe, for example, in ever having arguments about whether God exists. It's a ridiculous argument.
I understand.
Either you believe it or you don't.
Right.
What you do is you don't try to win the argument. You take your rational case to the American people and see if you can present enough facts to them that they will look at what you're saying. You don't fight on their grounds. You don't say, when Sarah Palin says you're the Antichrist, you don't say, I am not the Antichrist, and this is why. You say, Sarah Palin and John McCain are trying to change the subject, and they're trying to make you forget what dire economic straits the policies of their party have brought us to. You can't argue with anti-rationalism. That's exactly right.
I see. So the old adage that you're entitled to your argument, but not to your own facts.
Exactly.
That seems to be where what's going on here. I mean, I think it's pretty easy to detect the dynamic and certainly the strategy on the part of the Republicans, which is to throw stuff out all the time, throw out bogus facts, criticize and dismiss all of the rational arguments that the other side is making, and just spread confusion and hope to trap the other candidate into responding to your nonsense rather than putting forth his own ideas.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think that this is one reason that a lot of liberals, intellectuals, haven't actually understood this, that you don't fight on their grounds. There was an interesting piece in the New York Times today by Steven Pinker. In a way, it was an incredibly silly piece, because what he did was he said that the language Sarah Palin doesn't use, the doggonets and the heck of us and the dropping the G's and so on, that nobody should focus on that because that's just a regional dialect. Well, it's not. Again, it is a regional dialect, but I know a lot of people from Alaska who don't talk like that. It is the way stupid people talk when they are trying to act as if using bad grammar and winking and saying doggone it is what will make the American people forget that they actually have nothing to say. So I think that the mistake that intellectuals have made, that liberals have made, that a lot of Democrats have made, is trying to argue with these people as if they were presenting a rational argument. Now, Biden was hamstrung with Palin because of the woman factor. Poor little woman in her high heels. He couldn't possibly attack her. But Obama needn't be hamstrung with McCain in this. And instead of responding to attacks that aren't factual, he should keep on presenting the real facts about the economy in the economic debate and not respond to that kind of nonsense, to that. You know, in other words, when John McCain says Obama is going to raise all your taxes, he doesn't need to argue with him. He just needs to say over and over again that the tax cuts have only benefited the top earners in the country, and that's not most of you.
Right. But Obama continually says that we're not going to tax anybody under $250,000, and the Republicans keep saying anybody earning $42,000 is going to be taxed. It is such
If I were him, I would follow up the real fact with that's an outright lie. There's nothing wrong with that. You can't accuse poor little Sarah of lying. That's part of the that's another anti-rational conviction, which is that women can't be debated as toughly as men. You got to sort of pat them on the shoulder and when a woman says, well, I don't have to answer the question posed by the moderator, she just gets a pass on it.
Sure. Well, I must say, just in closing, Sister Kirby, I have never witnessed such aggressive cynicism in our national politics and in our lack of a debate. And it seems to me, I wish the press were demanding a higher quality of discourse.
Well, look, the press is part of the problem. Again, I think, for instance, in that vice presidential debate, both Sarah Palin and Biden should have been asked how they would apply their religion to public policy. They should have been asked whether they believe in the separation of church and state. They didn't touch any of those things. Of course, the economic issues are predominant in people's minds, but the press is very scared to attack anybody's irrational belief systems.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, and you certainly shed some clarity for me, Susan Jacoby, and thanks again for joining us today.
But it's frightening. I agree with you.
Thanks again. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Susan Jacoby, the author of a new book, The Age of American Unreason, that'll be coming out in paperback in the winter. And I'm now speaking with Scott Horton, who's a writer, analyst, and attorney known for his work in international law, human rights, and the law of armed conflict. He is a professor at Columbia Law School and the author of over 100 articles and is a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. His Harper's weblog, No Comment, is highly regarded and covers issues ranging from American law and politics to international affairs. Scott, it looks like we're finally going to have some justice prevailing at the Justice Department because of this internal report that found that politics were central to the firing of the United States attorneys And does that mean then that there's a possibility of Karl Rove and Alberto Gonzalez appearing in the dock?
Well, I think, of course, just before the report came out on Monday, Karl Rove's attorney and his PR flacks and those working for Alberto Gonzalez were all over the scene trying to put out the story that this report that was going to be released the next day was going to put an end to all these concerns and that there was, you know, no referral for Gonzalez to the grand jury, so the matter was closed. But, of course, when we got the report the next day, we saw, no, that's not at all the case. What we found is that the investigators felt that they couldn't bring their investigation to a conclusion. Why? Because they've been stonewalled. Karl Rove would not come, wouldn't testify, wouldn't turn over documents, neither would Harriet Myers, neither would a number of other people at the White House. And indeed, we see when they tried to look at what was going on with Republican figures in Congress, an awful lot of them and their staffers likewise would not appear, wouldn't answer questions, wouldn't turn over documents. So justice concluded that, look, it's got to be proceeded with as a prosecution, as a criminal investigation with a U.S. attorney mandated to handle it, prepared to issue subpoenas, and prepared to haul people before a grand jury. And that's the stage we're at now.
So you're a former, Scott Horton, you're a former law partner of the current Attorney General Mukasey, and there's been more than a sense that he's been stonewalling on a lot of issues. What do you think his motive is here? He had some kind of internal rebellion on his hand, did he not?
Well, I think the Inspector General did a very professional, proper job, and I think, in fact, all the reports that have come from the Inspector General in the last several years have been rigorous and professional. And I think, I think Michael Mukasey really knew that this was coming. But you look at his response, and it's a little telling, isn't it, when he appoints a special prosecutor and then tells her that he doesn't expect a report for 60 days. In other words, after the election, right. That was pretty obvious. When this matter has been open and under examination for 17, 18 months now, 19 months, actually. It should be coming to a conclusion very quickly. So it's very, very clear that Mukasey wants to see this dragged out until after the Bush team leave office. That's one thing. And then his selection of a special prosecutor. I would say he didn't go for the worst option, and he didn't go for the best option. He went for something pretty much in between, which is to say the best option really would have been someone who was independent of the Justice Department, someone who had the stature and moral authority to look Michael Mukasey right in the eye and say, go to hell, if that was the appropriate thing to do. Instead, he picked a fairly young prosecutor, who has never been involved in a complex political investigation of the sort that we see in Washington, but who has very, very good marks coming out of Connecticut. In fact, I interviewed a lot of people up in the Connecticut bar and in her office, and everyone thinks the world of her, but, they also all think that she's, relatively young and inexperienced for an appointment of this sort, but she may be up to it. So we'll see.
Well, I've interviewed the U.S. attorney from New Mexico who seems to have been the most exonerated. It didn't suggest that Carol Lam's firing was as political as it certainly appeared to be some kind of political payback for the fact that she embarrassed the Republicans with getting Randy Cunningham in jail. There was, here in Los Angeles, it looks as though the U.S. attorney was sort of bought off by the administration and got a plum job in a law firm of which the Solicitor General is a partner, Ted Olson. And she was looking into a whole bunch of crooked congressmen that we have out here in the Inland Empire.
Lewis, for instance.
Jerry Lewis, who the FBI have been looking at, and Ken Calvert, who's always tops the list of crooks in Washington. There's another one, too. I can't think of his name. It'll come to me in a minute, at a Diamond Bar as well. So it's pretty odious that here in the blue state of California, we've got these sort of unbelievably flagrant crooks. But so.
But you're right. I think, you know, I think the report, as I read it, it's reasonably strong dealing with the facts and case in New Mexico. And it says it couldn't take that to the conclusion because Pete Domenici, you know, key figure here, and some key people in the White House refused to talk about what happened. So they can carry the story about 90% of the way, but not all the way home. But it's, you know, pretty obvious what went on there and pretty obvious that it was political manipulation. So he's sustained, I think. The two cases in California, and I say two because it's both the Los Angeles case and the case involving Carol Lam down in San Diego, those are, I think, the weakest parts of the report. They say they were unable to find information showing political manipulation in either case. But when you look at their investigation, they didn't look for them. There's a lot of, in fact, there's an awful lot of material on the public record that they didn't take notice of. There are an awful lot of people that they didn't interview. So they really turned a blind eye to what was happening out in California. That's pretty disturbing. And you know, and I think, you know, they really don't even purport to deal with the case in Los Angeles. But the Los Angeles and the San Diego cases are very closely tied together. And the record shows very clearly, if you just look at the timeline, that Lam was targeted when she started going after Cunningham and was fired when that investigation expanded to include aspects of the Jerry Lewis case, which he was also looking at. And it's also clear that, you know, because of the Jerry Lewis case, there were strong concerns expressed about both of those two U.S. attorneys, and that is Deborah Wong and Carol Lam, and that Yang's name appeared on the list to be terminated and then was taken off after Ted Olson, as you described it, you know, intervened and basically gave her a job at Gibson Dunn, a very, very prominent Los Angeles law firm. And now, of course, Ted Olson was the attorney representing Jerry Lewis. And Ted Olson appears during this time period to have had several discussions with key figures in the White House who were involved in the purge of the U.S. Attorney's Office. Yet there was no attempt to interview him or the White House people about what went on in this connection. Now, that's just an inexplicable failure, I think.
But Scott Horton, all of the investigations that the FBI have done, which appear to have been buried, is there any way that the special prosecutor can resurrect them?
Well, I think, you know, I think the special prosecutor will have an independent right to follow the leads as she sees them. So yes, it's very, very clear that the special prosecutor is authorized to go in and develop all these facts surrounding the cashiering of these U.S. attorneys. But that doesn't mean that she'll have the right to pick up and deal with the Jerry Lewis matter, for instance, you know, which is a nominally still open file in the Central District of California, although it looks like it's basically been shut down.
Mm-hmm. So that's a no in terms of getting the FBI files.
I think she would be entitled to look at what was done in the handling of that investigation. But what we've seen consistently so far is this sort of hear no evil, speak no evil, see no evil attitude on the part of the Justice Department, where they don't want to. They want to assume that everything is going correct. Mm-hmm. Even when they're presented with very substantial evidence, albeit circumstantial evidence that it isn't, when they're presented with all that evidence, their reaction is, well, you know, you haven't given me anybody admitting that they're doing something wrong.
To which, as if, know, that happens.
Course, that people don't admit. I mean,
exactly. You know. So just in closing, Scott Horton, the U.S. attorney down in Arkansas, of course, was clearly fired to make room for a protege of Karl Rove. Karl Rove's fingerprints are all over this, and Karl Rove clearly is running the McCain-Palin campaign through his protege. So, and a lot of liberals, of course, particularly going back to the case of the CIA officer who was outed, the Scooter Libby case, were hoping that Rove would be nailed. He was actually spared in the Fitzgerald inquiry because a reporter from Time magazine gave him the heads up that he had perjured himself, and he was able to go back and re-testify. So thanks to the press, he got a pass. So I guess this is a long-winded way of asking you, do you ever think that Karl Rove's going to get nailed?
I think he's right in the crosshairs now. I mean, you look at this report by the Department of Justice, it says that Kyle Sampson is the key person who's responsible for the firings. And it also says Kyle Sampson's taking marching orders from the White House. Now, inside the White House, Kyle Sampson was referred to as Karl Rove's mini-me. He looked like and acted like Karl Rove, and he basically was Karl Rove's implementer. So I think, you know, we don't know the details because Karl Rove hasn't yet testified, but I think they're going to come down like a ton of bricks on Karl Rove. I think he's going to be hauled before the grand jury and asked a lot of unpleasant questions. And I think if he answers honestly, he's going to wind up being indicted.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Scott Horton.
My pleasure.
And again, I was just speaking then with Scott Horton, writer, analyst, and attorney, known for his work in international law, human rights, and the law of armed conflict. He's a professor at Columbia Law School, and he was the former partner of the current Attorney General Mukasey. His Harper's Web blog is No Comment. And I'd like to thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.